come celebrate 40 years of Unix at the Ohio Linux Fest from September 25th through the 27th. If you use GNU Linux, BSD, OpenSolaris, or any Unix or Unix-like system, you belong at Ohio Linux Fest. Register free today at ohiolinux.org.
Welcome to Tit Radio Episode 5. I'm Monster B, and on the call with me today is Azmuth.
Howdy, howdy.
Mac Machine B.
Hello, hello.
330.
Mushy, mushy.
The Zokes.
Bonsoir.
And the Sheriff, Peter 64.
G'day.
And his deputy, Claude 2.
Hello, everyone.
Well, I did get one feedback from Speaker X. We talked about... Where's that noise coming from?
I think Klaatu is watching Aliens. He must have got homesick.
not on my end. Sorry.
I can't hear a thing. Maybe it is me. Hold on. I'll mute.
It's someone's chair squeaking while they're rocking back and forth, or they're slaughtering like a pig or something.
That's what it sounds like. Well, Seekerx sent an email saying thanks for addressing his question. Linux equivalents to Fruity Loops. And that was the only feedback I got.
Well, we got some feedback on the site, though.
Oh, cool.
We got like 3 or 4 comments on the site.
Yeah, but they were all from the same bloke. He just posted them like 4 times.
Yeah. Well, he had an issue with, I don't know, I'll just read it, actually. So this guy's named Zafsod B. Block, and he's commenting primarily on the Hadoopy router, which is the story that I'd done like last week or whenever that show was, about the router that would like automatically find all the networks around you and track them for you. And he says, while I agree with most of the roundtable comments in principle, the problem with using these routers or similar ideas in the USA is that the RIAA or MPAA is they don't care if you really have offending files on your computer. Remember, they have sued people that never owned computers before in the good old USA. They sue first or demand settlements, and the person that gets into their site might not be able to afford a lawyer or a settlement. I'd be willing to bet that you'd feel like crap if someone in a neighborhood got fingered for $6,000 by the RIAA for your torrenting. Now in France, where they actually need proof, I say go for it. Here in the USA, where you only get the law, you can buy Klaatu's idea is just going to cause some poor innocent misery. That kind of thoughtless action gives all geeks and hacker types a bad name. Either way, I love the podcast. So those are his thoughts about the Hadoopy router. And to that, I personally say I don't agree. I think that the Hadoopy router is a great idea because I don't think the people getting hurt are going to be the ones, you know, being cracked, you know, having their routers used by other people. I think the people who are going to get hurt are the people trying to monitor and sort of keep tabs or judge the kind of traffic that each of us is utilizing. You know, it's kind of like spreading the wealth. We're all giving each other equal amounts of torrenting and questionable activity so that people trying to look at our traffic and throttle our bandwidth or, you know, persecute us or whatever, they can't really finger us because it's everyone, you know, it's on everyone's network. That's my personal opinion. Anyone else have a thought about that?
I second your opinion.
Fantastic. Creepy.
I think we got takeoff.
Takeoff.
Man.
So you get noise now, Bill?
Yeah, that's pretty loud.
Yeah, that was
okay.
Really loud.
I'll mute. Tell me if it's any noise here.
No, it's quiet.
Quiet. But it doesn't.
And now it's back.
No.
Is it back?
No, it's like a weird, like...
It comes in at weird times.
I was just wondering if... Like, there's no noise at all in this room. I just wondered maybe if it was Twinkle or something. But I can't hear a thing. That's why I'm wondering if it's got something to do with my end.
I don't think it's you.
Well, I was muted all the time Klaatu was talking. So if you heard it then...
No, we didn't hear it then.
No, we didn't. We heard it, like, right after 3:30 said I second your motion or whatever.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure it was muted. But anyway, I don't know. I'm just wondering why I can't hear it.
And like Peter says, everyone else who comments is pretty much the same guy, except the last comment, which says, I usually have a critical eye, but this is the best podcast I have heard in a long time. I really appreciate the kudos for Linux and older hardware. All the topics are actually enjoyable. Keep up the good vibe. And that's from Davey Jordan. Someone obviously paid him off to write that. Him or...
I didn't do it.
Huh? Well, that's because you're broke.
Yeah.
It was me. I paid in Australian money, so it really didn't cost me that much.
Oh, right. Okay, cool. Good idea.
Both of you. 2 minutes. Get in there. Put a shit on the track. This is the first time the deputy's been sent to the movie bin, too.
You can't send a deputy.
Yeah, I can, because I'm the sheriff.
Yeah, well, what are they going to do to him there?
Make me Make sure you get some good pictures.
Come here, boy. You got a real pretty smile. I'm going to make that blue hair stand on end.
Well, Sheriff, you want to kick it off? The first topic?
Yeah, I can. I've just got a quick one here. This is carrying on our astronomical theme that I sort of started off with Celestia and whatever the other one was. Now, this one here, I was talking to Derek, who hasn't been in his comfy chair for a while, and he pointed out this little site called Galaxy Zoo. And what this is it appears that us humans are a hell of a lot better in discerning shapes and that. And what you have is this Sloan Digital Sky Survey telescope that just goes, and I think it's imaged about a quarter of the sky. And then what they ask people, originally, this is actually Galaxy Zoo, the second one. The original one was just purely going in and saying, okay, is this picture of a galaxy? Yes. Can you see any arms emanating from the center outwards, you know, like in a spiral fashion? Yes, etc., like that. And the beauty of that was these images that you were looking at, you were the first person ever to see them, because this Sloan Digital telescope is actually a robotic telescope that just goes off and just takes pictures. And then with this second incarnation of the site, you actually go in a lot deeper, and you might say, okay, yes, this image does have spiral arms, or maybe a galaxy on its side or whatever. Then you go off in and answer more questions about it. And a few interesting things have actually come out of it. This in particular is called Vorwerp or something it's called anyway. I just stuck over and have a look at the site. There's some interesting reading on it. But this one bloke had a look at this picture, and there was this sort of blue thing underneath, and he just posted in the forums and said, oh, what the hell is this? And as a consequence of that, they've named this sort of after that bloke. They're still not quite sure what it is. And also why you're having...
But it has a name now.
Yeah, that's right. They named it, they called it after him. And just some of the images that this Sloan scope takes are just worth perusing. Just post them in too so you can have a look. I mean, they're just beautiful images. But anyway, get over there. I mean, I joined up, and, you know, and some of them, if you stare too long, you start to see things like spaceships, Klaatu. You'll love this site. So it's pretty good. It's you know, something to look at with your kids. If you don't have kids, it's enjoyable anyway. So that's just a quick one today.
And this is like classifying the galaxies, right? That's what you're doing. You're saying this is a spiral galaxy. This is a, I forget what the other classification is.
It says if it goes, if it goes clockwise or anti-clockwise, whether there's any other thing in the picture that might be of interest to you, whether it could be a you know, you get that classic cigar-shaped galaxy with the bulge in the center, so you're actually looking at a galaxy side-on. Just heaps of questions like that. But it's very easy because all you're choosing is virtually a yes or no. You know, they show you a picture, you get to choose either whether it's this or that, then you say it's this, then the next time it'll say, okay, so this, this or this, and then you just, very easy to do.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Any more questions on this one? How about you, Klaatu? What do you got for us?
Okay. So has anyone heard of this? This is kind of cool. They're apparently around the same time that Google had released, you know, the big press release about Chrome OS or whatever. That's the obligatory Chrome OS mentioned for this episode, by the way. But apparently around the same time, they released an open source. It's called NeatX. Has anyone heard of this before?
No.
Okay, so this is basically where you can use, and I haven't tried this yet because I just found out about it, but you can use, you know, like SSH over into your box or whatever, remotely. And rather than just doing a normal X forwarding session, you would use NeatX, and this will basically it compresses all of the different X, system requests or whatever, so that you're forwarding X, but you're doing so. I reckon you're like utilizing a lot more of your local resources and just compressing the system calls, you know, from the remote box. But it's supposed to speed up, you know, the graphical response. When you're doing the X forwarding dramatically. And the name of the project is NeatX, which is just N-E-A-T, the letter X. And I guess it's by Google, but it is apparently GPL, you know, so it's kosher. It uses the NX protocol, which is, it compresses the X request.
Do you have any links to this so I can put it in the show notes?
Yeah, I do. I've got probably the best place to do it. It's just code.google.com/neatx, N-E-A-T-X. I'll put that in IRC as well. Just have it written down. I don't know if you're logging this or not.
Yeah, I do everything around here with sticky notes, Klaatu.
Okay, well, yeah. code.google.com/neatx, N-E-A-T-X. Eager to try that one myself.
Sticky notes. Was that a lead-in for my story?
Yep.
Ooh, pretty slick.
Well, on the subject of sticky notes, yeah, I mean, you know, so that Art don't have to keep them pasted in the center of his forehead anymore, run across a little program called Zim. And I heard Chad mention it on his show here a week or so ago and went and looked at it and played with it. And It's a really neat little desktop wiki. And the whole thing is, after you play with it just a little bit, it all of a sudden dawns on you that it's just almost the same as Tomboy Notes, except it uses Perl and Python, no mono.
Cool.
And has conned it
you
Zim?
Zim, Z-I-M. Let me put it in the... There's a link to the project, I went looking, and it's in Ubuntu's repositories, after I already downloaded it and was playing with it on a Ubuntu machine, I found it comes as part of the original install on AntiX.
It's also really good for doing to-do notes and stuff. It works good, and it changes it automatically.
Yeah, you know, you link the darn things. It's just like HTML. In fact, you can export them as HTML. You can, you go over to the Zim site, and you'll find that the whole site was written in their little notebook program.
Project actually using their own project for their project. That's pretty cool. That's good.
Yeah, that's a neat little tag at the bottom of their page, you know, that says this whole site was written in Zim.
Right. Always an encouraging.
So, you know, heck, if nothing else, use it for WYSIWYG HTML editor.
That's all Tomboy is. Basically, it's just like Yeah, basically like a desktop local wiki.
Yeah, that. Yeah, Tomboy and it look almost identical, and the functions are so close that it's hard to tell them apart.
Yeah, I was always confused as to why Tomboy was such a shining example of Mono. I was just like, seems like it's just like a slightly fancy notepad, or little internal database kind of thing. I could never understand why everyone got so excited about it all the time.
I used to use Tomboy quite a bit, and then not too long ago I saw something somewhere about a port of Tomboy over to C++.
Yeah.
And it's called Gnote. And it's the same exact thing. It's just written in C++. I just posted a link in the IRC channel if anybody wants to check it out. But looks like everything is pretty much ported over. Some of the add-ons are still being worked on, and the synchronization support is still being developed also, but everything else is up to par.
Well, it's plain that you don't have to have Mono to have a desktop note taker or a desktop wiki.
Exactly.
So what do these use for, like, a back-end for a database? So using the tiny... SQL?
That one,
yeah.
The new one called Couch or something. That isn't that supposed to be like some kind of SQL? Sort of a new hip desktop SQL?
Well, I was just wondering how easy it would be to back this stuff up. Like everything you put in here, there's an easy way to back it up and move it to a different system.
Probably just a hidden folder in your home directory, I would imagine. I would hope.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it's got.
So what do you blokes use these things for?
I don't.
Yeah, I just couldn't see the need.
It's
never take notes?
No, isn't it obvious when I'm talking? I just don't know what I'm talking about, and that's why.
I make notes of any interesting stories that fit.
The only thing I've got a text file. I think I mentioned before, I call it Jay Lindsay, and it's all the tips I've got off him in the... Maybe I could use it for that.
I mean,
well, yeah, plus you can put links in this.
Yeah, I don't know, I suppose a lot of people must use them because there's so many of them out there.
Well, I mean, it's nice. Like, I used to use Tomboy all the time when I was doing programming stuff. Like, I would take and throw, like, snippets in a separate note, and then you could link the notes together, to-do lists, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the Zim does look neat because I don't know, I might try this, because, I like the layout of the website that they made on zim-wiki.org. I mean, it's simple, but it'd be nice just for, like platypuslinux.org. Yeah, I might be able to use this for an easy way to input stuff.
Well, I found sometimes it's nice to put pictures in your notes, and this sure works good for that.
So what is it, like, because I'm looking at the screenshot, it says format up there, would I be able to type something out and then, like, export it to HTML? Or how would that work?
Yeah, well, you just export the whole page to HTML. You know, and all you have is a HTML file then that you can open in a browser.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to look at this.
Am I the only one that thinks that Zim looks overly complicated?
Yes. Next question.
You must be, because it's not. I mean, it's one of the simplest looking programs I've ever seen.
It's got some cool little things, like I said, the to-do list. You can just do open square brackets, close square brackets, and then whatever it is. And then, like, the number of exclamation marks is how important it should be. So you can, there's a couple of shortcuts like that you can just do, and it'll suddenly populate a to-do list for you.
Yeah, it's like anything. Yeah, you can make it as simple or as complicated as you want.
Mrs. A wants to run in the windows.
I believe.
Shall I shoot it now?
It is cross-ported.
Yes, it is.
I believe it will run Windows or Mac or whatever. It's.
I'm looking at the download page. It has Windows, Arch Linux, Debian, Gentoo, Fedora, FreeBSD.
Pretty much anywhere there's a monitor, it'll run.
Yep. All right. Any more questions on this one? All right, let's move on to Snack Machine.
Well, I found this is not really Linux oriented, but I thought this was kind of cool. I've been dealing with a lot of camera stuff lately, and Canon just introduced a new type of image stabilizer. So you know when you're taking a picture and your hands are real shaky and ends up blurring the picture, well, they have image stabilization built into a lot of cameras anymore. Well, Canon developed a hybrid image stabilization, so it not only covers the linear, which is, you know, the normal stabilization that you pretty much find anywhere now, but it also does rotational as well. So as you're moving, and you turn the camera, you could have it at an angle, turning it, and it's going to keep your picture nice and crisp. It's really, really cool.
Or just cut down on the coffee.
And this is just in their new, their newest high-end digital cameras, or?
Yeah, it's in, they're going to start putting it in their new SLR models.
Okay. Cool.
That are coming out. This was just announced on the 22nd. This was announced. And then it says on the site, I'll post the link here in a second. It'll be for use any lenses going forward as of July 17th of 2009. Will work with the new stabilization techniques.
No, I think it sounds cool. I mean, I love Canon cameras.
Yeah, so do I.
My Canon's 17 years old and still working strong. And Mrs. Oak's Canon's even older and still working. I had issues with mine a while back. It was doing weird, horrible, blurry lines, but there's a worldwide recall on the Canon cameras because they had a dodgy batch of CCDs, so they repaired it free, basically, even though it was like 5 years old. They didn't care. They just took and fixed it. Now it works great again.
Yeah, I've been watching. They've had a bunch of different firmware updates for different models, and like you say, they had a recall on a bunch of the CCD sensors, so they were replacing a lot of those. And they were one of the first ones also to come out with HD video on SLR cameras, also with their latest model, the T1i, I believe it is. And this is just another thing that's gonna, you know, make photography that much better. Because I mean, unless you're sitting there with a tripod, I mean, there's always some sort of camera shake that you're gonna have unless you're really, really steady.
Well, and even then, like in certain light conditions, it's almost impossible to be steady enough.
Exactly.
I don't know how good this image stabilization is, though. I guess I'd want to see it first before I sat around and praised it. But, I mean, like I say, and like Zoe said, Canon really, they do seem to make really good cameras.
Yeah.
Any more comments on this one?
Nope.
You want to go next, Zoe?
Sure, I've got a... One 330 might be interested in. It's a website called Privacy Choice or privacychoice.org. I'll post it into if I hit the right button, I'll paste it into the IRC. Basically, there's a bunch of ad networks that give you cookies and screw around with you and stuff to see what you're doing. But quite a lot of them have opt-outs. If you go to a particular thing, they'll give you a cookie to opt out. This website just gives you like 89 cookies that opts you out of all these companies. So things like Google AdSense, DoubleClick, Yahoo, and AOL. You just click on it, it gives you a bunch of cookies, and you're opted out, at least in theory. I haven't gone and tested it fully, but it looks like a cool idea. They've even got a Firefox add-on, which will automatically restore them if your cookies are ever wiped.
Just on your big Firefox bookmark repository?
No, it's not. As I said, I haven't gone through and played around with it entirely yet. But I said, you can just go to the website and click on it, and it'll give you the cookies. What you can do is the other one. I haven't got a big sort of anonymous, paranoid Linux version. Sorry, paranoid Firefox add-ons list yet, unlike some people. But I think it's a cool idea to instantly opt you out of everything.
So how does it work? It's putting cookies on your computer from privacy choice?
Basically, I mean, there's a learn how this works thing, so I shall read you the blurb here. The privacy choice wizard uses cookies, small files written, blah, 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 you know what a cookie is. Nearly all websites use web cookies for useful things, like remembering your username from visit to visit. Since web pages consist of content served by many companies, any or all of them may serve cookies on your machine through that page. They include networks that provide advertising companies that do market research. By recognizing your browsers, you visit different sites. These companies collect information about your overall activities and interests. Tracking cookies that offer an opt-out from this profiling provide a special cookie that tells their systems not to record your behavior when your browser communicates with their servers. Rather than have you visit all of these individual network sites to opt out, you can use Privacy Choice to cause your browser to collect those cookies from all those different networks at the push of one button. And you can either choose to opt out completely or opt out selectively. The Privacy Choice browser add-on makes your opt-out preferences permanent by rewriting all the opt-out cookies on your computer whenever cookies are cleared or whenever you start a new browser session in case cookies are deleted from your computer. The browser add-on also provides the most complete coverage since it writes opt-out cookies for all networks, even those that block our web-based wizard.
Hmm.
I mean, if you're using something like CookieSafe or a different plugin to get rid of, you know, Squid or Privoxy or something to block cookies anyway, I don't think it's going to matter. But I thought it was an interesting little thing that you just click here and it opts you out of a lot of them.
So that you can never opt out too many times.
I mean, of course, this is assuming you trust Privacy Choice, the website.
Do you trust them?
I've not gone through... I mean, I've just looked at what they say they do. The next thing is to go to various websites and look at who's talking about Privacy Choice, you know, and then see, you know, links to or whatever the command is under Google or similar, just see what's going on. I haven't fully... I figured I'd just tell 330 in here, look, and if he gave it the 330 stamp of approval, then we knew it was good.
Give it the tin hat seal of approval.
Could you look it over and let us know, 330?
Yeah, I will. I just did it and turned off all my other anti-cookie add-ons, so I'll go digging through and see what it's doing.
I don't know. Stuff like this scares me because how do you know they're not going to grab your Google account or Yahoo account or PayPal or, you know, they grab the cookie that you're supposed to get. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the cookie shouldn't have any of your login information on it.
Like, okay, like your Google account, where does it store it?
It would be in...
I thought that was stored in a cookie.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right.
Because if they're replacing it with their cookie, and then you go to Google, what if it sends it to them?
Well, they're saying that, what I understand from what I just read out, you click on it, and it takes you to their opt-out page, not Privacy Choice, I mean Google AdSense or whatever. That's what they're suggesting.
We're just trying to pick it apart, so that's all.
No, that's fine. Go ahead. I mean, I said I'm still looking into it to figure out if it's any good. I mean, I just found one interesting thing. If you go to aboutus.org/privacychoices.org. Hang on, privacy choices. Not
plural.
Yeah. I was going to say privacy choices appears to be owned by DoubleClick. .net.
Oh, really?
That's what it says. That's what About Us says. Title Privacy Choices, Language English. Gives an address and then says contact hostmaster at doubleclick.net.
Wow.
That actually, because, yeah, that's the wrong thing. It's Privacy Choice, not Privacy Choices. So that is kind of funny if DoubleClick's trying to get a website that's very similar.
Yeah.
It does sound like they're doing something good because they're pissing off DoubleClick.
Yeah.
No, I clean my cookies out like probably like every 2 hours. I mean, if I'm gonna order something online or go somewhere to log in, I usually clean my cookies out, and, you know, clean everything out in Firefox.
Yeah, well, that just makes the tracking ineffective.
Or less effective, anyway.
Oh.
Because while you're still logged in and doing stuff. As I said, I just use CookieSafe and get it to block pretty much every cookie unless I really, really need it.
Yeah, in Conker, you can pretty much configure it that way, too. You can just say, bother with cookies, or, you know, ask me about them, and then I just have it block it. Really think about it, to be honest. I don't really find that many sites seem to, like, demand that I have cookies anymore, or that I accept cookies anymore.
Banking sites do, don't they?
Yeah, I don't really do any banking. Well, I do some banking online, but I don't know, I guess my site doesn't.
Yeah, I just seem to recall not being able to access mine. I think I had to enable cookies.
Hey, the worst thing is JavaScript. You can't do any damn thing on the internet without JavaScript anymore.
Yeah, yeah. One of them, either E-Links or Link, has some pretty good JavaScript sort of features, where even if you're doing something like in a text-based browser, it'll kind of emulate what's going on with that JavaScript, or it'll tell you that something's trying to run, and it'll kind of let you know what it's trying to do. I forget which one it is, though. It's either E-Links or Links.
Well, speaking of milk and cookies and beards, you got anything for us, 330?
Yeah, I do, and amazingly, it has nothing to do with tinfoil hats or being crazy or anything like that, and it'll probably be the least technical thing discussed tonight, but as a lover of the Matrix and the Matrix View screensaver, I figured I'd talk about how to change the pictures in it, because I don't know about you guys, but I can only look at Neo and Trinity for so long before I go, we gotta change this. So, as sudo or root, if you edit /user/share/applications/screensaver/matrixview.desktop, and where it says exec, if you make that matrixview --r --image-, and then the path to your pictures, it'll actually just put up, you know, a single folder of your pictures. You can't have them multiple folders deep. And I actually found that spray paint templates actually kind of work the best, because they're already made to be read, you know, through a terribly fuzzy medium.
Pretty cool. What's this screensaver called, though? I don't actually know the one that you're talking about. What's it called? Matrix View?
Yeah. It's I know it's in the GNOME screensaver pack.
I usually just have my screen going black, but I'll check this out.
I thought the Matrix screensaver was just the ones and zeros cascading down the screen.
What I imagined it would be.
Let's say there's that one also, but this is the characters cascading down the screen, and then they morph into a picture. So it's kind of like you're looking through the Matrix at a real thing. Kind of trippy when you walk by and you know, your screen says, you know, rise up, and it's in, you know, Matrix code.
Now, speaking of the Matrix code, Clatu, did you watch The 13th Floor yet?
No.
Well, I actually sat and watched it again yesterday, just to make sure it's as good as I remember it back from 10 years ago or more. And I'm going to say, do yourself a favor, sit down and watch it. Very enjoyable movie.
Okay. It is in my queue somewhere.
It's been in there for bloody 12 months.
Yeah, at least. No, I'll turn my attention back towards that.
Yeah, I've seen that movie, Peter. It's not real bad. It's got some things that are... It's very. Have you ever seen, was it Dark City, Klaatu?
Yeah, like that.
Okay, so it's kind of like the combination of, say, Dark City and The Matrix. Kind of push those two together, and that's kind of what The 13th Floor is like.
Cool. Get into that.
Anything else, 330?
Nope.
All right, cool. And, Mrs. Oak, you have a story for us?
Yeah. I actually did my homework this week. Or tried. It's about the Apple iPhone and some of the apps that are created for it. One in particular. The link is already in IRC for those of you who want to read about it. But what's funny is that it was developed by, I think it said, a guy named Schwartz. And the funniest part about it is the app itself doesn't do anything, but it's one of the most popular apps being downloaded to the iPhone.
Mrs. A, you're talking about the iPhone on a Linux podcast. Well, not that it's really Linux.
But
Zake, sorry, get to the bin for letting your wife talk about an iPhone. 5 minutes. I can't believe it. Sorry, Mrs. A, go ahead. So what does this app do? Nothing.
Nothing. It looks like the frame on a mirror. And I guess if you look at your leaving the screen of your iPhone behind that frame black. So I guess if you look at your iPhone, when you have this app up, it acts like a mirror.
The one that always amused me was that one that I am filthy rich and it cost $9,999 or whatever it bloody was.
Yeah.
And what, 7 people bought it?
Yeah. So you know there's a app for the MAMO device is called I Am Free. And it does the exact same thing as I Am Rich.
Except it's free.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty clever. You know, I find a lot of those iPhone apps, I mean, like, every store I pass on the street has a sign out front these days saying, quick, go download our iPhone app. And it's just like, I don't even know what it is. It looks like, from the advertisement, it looks like it's just their webpage, you know? Except instead of having to go to their webpage, it's just like, it's a quote-unquote app for your iPhone.
Well, the state of New York, or the city of New York, just came up with an iPhone app that allowed you to piss and moan about things. So, like, if there was, like, a stop sign that was obfuscated by a tree, you could take a picture of it, attach that to your complaint, and send it in from your iPhone.
I see. And what happens to it then, I wonder? It's summarily ignored?
I'll say some kid working there for the summer is tasked at deleting all of them.
Right.
What I found the funniest about this particular app was that they say in the description of the app, it pretty much tries to discourage anybody from downloading, and it only has an average rating of 1.5 stars, but it seems to be one of the most popular ones downloaded. And I guess they're making $2,000 a day in revenue just based on the ad revenue.
That's classic.
Yeah.
Well, it's like that, yeah, it's like when you come up on the scene of an accident and there's some cop going, all right, everybody, there's nothing to see here.
Yeah, suddenly everyone.
Well, if there was nothing to see, he wouldn't be standing out there saying it. Same reason people download this app. I'm going to go buy an iPhone and download it right now. I'll be damned if they tell me what I'm going to look at.
Right.
So these are probably the same people that buy ringtones.
Yeah. Four individuals.
You said sometimes you walk down the street and you see signs, people that say download their iPhone app. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it seems like out in front of every store that I pass on the street these days, there's like an ad in their window saying, download our iPhone app. And I think that they're basically just bookmarks to their site or something like
that. No, I've never seen anything like that.
Well, when I say all of the stores, I mean like two.
Oh.
I think we need a tit radio app.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what I think it is, Klaatu, is not only like a bookmark to their site, but a lot of them will have like, you know, like an online checkout type thing where they have an account and they can go in and they can place orders from there or pay a balance or something like that. More than likely that's something like what it is. I don't know.
Yeah, you're probably right. I do find it odd. I mean, I don't know. I mean, are iPhones actually that, I guess, that overwhelmingly popular that, you know, these places have to come up with an iPhone app as opposed to apps for whatever other cell phones are out there? Are iPhones actually that popular? Are they winning by a slide in terms of mobile?
Go
ahead, Peter.
Well, I was just going to ask a question because I'm not a phone head, but how many other phone companies sell apps for their phone?
Good question.
Well, all the Windows Mobile phones have app stores or just have websites that you can go and buy the app.
Yeah, but they don't push it. And like, when I get on my phone, whatever bloody is running Windows CE, it doesn't. There's no store on there. It's just running Windows Mobile and and you could surf on the internet and go to a store, but doesn't the iPhone push the store?
Yeah, well, the iPhone, some Blackberries, the Palm Pre, the Android phones.
Yeah, so, okay, there's quite a few out there who do push a store. Yeah, interesting.
Well, it's all the new phones, all the new smartphones do.
Because all the new smart companies have realized that's where the money is.
Yeah. Saying, before it would be tied to your cell provider. So, like, you'd have the Verizon or Sprint app store, you know, and it'd be a little thing on your phone that you can't ever get rid of for any damn reason.
That's absolutely right. And the thing with you know, especially with the iPhone, is that that's where a lot of the developers are right now, is the iPhone. But you're starting to see a lot of people not necessarily going from iPhone to, say, Android or Symbian, anything like that, but they're starting to develop app stores, so to speak, that are not carrier specific,
yeah,
that are for the platform, not the carrier. So, you know, people can, you know, either take a phone from one carrier to another or something of that nature. They're more likely to purchase apps of their phone, especially since they're hitting a wider market. They can lower the cost of their apps, which makes people more likely to buy said apps. And the more people that, you know, are buying them, then, of course, the more money they're going to make.
And the thing is all the SDKs are in some way similar. Yeah, there are only so many programming languages in the world. Yeah, so you can write your iPhone app and take almost the same exact code, recompile it for the G1, and then you can recompile it for, you know, the Palm Pre. Well, not the Palm Pre, you'd have to write it in Ajax, but you know, it's all, you know, they all have similar hardware types and everything, so you know, it really kind of makes sense to have a carrier agnostic store going on.
Yeah, that's right, and that's pretty much, you know, how it is with not necessarily mobile software, but any software. I mean, programming languages, once you get one down and you start to look at another one, I mean, you know, everything kind of falls into place, and you can port one thing, you know, from one platform to another, and it's not as much work as if you were starting from scratch.
I must admit, maybe it's because I'm old, I just don't get this phone thing. Like, still, the screens are just way too small to surf the internet. Like, the one I just got Wi-Fi, I thought, great. I can get on YouTube or whatever, and do all this, and then you do it once just because you can, and you never do it again.
Yeah, I can't get into the phone thing either, honestly.
Yeah.
Really, it's not bad with devices like the iPhone, and even some of the newer Android devices, like the what is it, the G1, the G3, because a lot of them are the touchscreen, touch, you know, multi-touch, where you can stretch and shrink the screen as you want.
Yeah, that's the problem I find. Like, the screens are just way too little. And even when you're surfing the internet, you're going to sites that are for mobile devices, aren't you? Like, they always seem to have a /M at the end of them. But they still don't format the page well enough for me to be able to read without scrolling all over the place.
I don't know about you guys, but I just burn up my Centro battery. It's been about 3 days now, and I feel like a crackhead. I am dying without this phone.
So it's a 330. Do you use it as a phone, or do you use it as an internet tablet?
I use it as both.
Okay.
See, I haven't tried Twitter. I did one Twitter from it, and I thought, well, that was fun. I don't know, you either do it on a PC, or if you don't have a PC, you don't worry about it until you get home.
Well, see, my phone I actually use more as an internet device than I do as a phone.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
I think that's how I would use a phone as well. If I had one, I would just be using up the data left and right, but I would I would like not even use the talk minutes at all.
Yeah, I use way more data than I do voice minutes.
But why do you do it? Because you don't have a laptop handy, or because you're right on the move, or?
Well, I'm on the move, or it's something that isn't. It's something that's gonna take just long enough that, you know, walking over to my computer or booting up my Triple E is going to take longer than the thing I'm actually doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I do with my Nokia. I mean, if I'm just, no matter where I am, it's probably in my pocket, so I can just, you know, open up the Nokia, which is on anyway, and, you know, check my fire, check my RSS or whatever.
How big's the screen, Klaatu, on the N800? It's getting around 4 inches, is it, or something?
It's about 4 inches diagonal.
It's about, yeah, it's probably about, yeah.
Yeah, I could see that as probably being usable, but like a 2.5-inch or even 3-inch screen on a phone is just too small.
Yeah, one thing that's nice is, I mean, I always have a high-speed data connection, whereas, you know, say if I were to bring a, like a netbook or notebook even, I wouldn't have that data connection with it unless I you know, tethered my phone to it, and I, you know, I really don't need to do that if I can just use my phone. And that's one less thing I've got to carry around with me, you know?
Yeah. Say, like, I use my phone for that. It's like, why do people have a desktop and a laptop? Well, because you don't want to carry your damn desktop everywhere. Yeah, and you just get into this thing where it's smaller and smaller and smaller increments of use. Yeah, you're like, well, what's going to be easier, finding a Wi-Fi connection that I can steal to use the N800, or just use the cell, you know, the modem that's in my cell phone to look up, you know, how many houses Liberace had that had tigers in them, or some dumb shit like that.
15.
Like, I think the most frequent and it would be great if I could speak English. If someone would make an app for that, that would be nice.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, but the most frequently used web page on my phone is Wikipedia. Because somebody will spout off something and I'll go, that's bullshit, and take out my phone and start looking it up. I've settled many of arguments that way.
Yeah, and that I mean, that's the kind of stuff. I mean, I use my phone for the exact same thing all the time, and I looked up my data plan not too long ago, and I think this last month or so, I used probably close to 120 megs on my phone. I mean, that's how much I use the data on my phone, and I barely used, you know, like a 16th of my actual voice plan.
Yeah. Saying, and 120 megs doesn't sound like that much, but it is like a 2 or 3 inch screen. So how much data can you push across that screen in a month?
Yeah.
You know, because all cell modems of any type are capped at 5 gigs by the FCC. You know, and everybody goes, 5 gigs? I've never been able to do more than 5 gigs on my phone. I tried. I couldn't find enough data to push through it.
Yep, and it's torrent enough stuff to your phone.
The one time the data usage on my phone was awesome was I needed to get an ISO of Ubuntu for some reason. And I was on my way home, so I SSH'd into my server after I had gone on the web and gotten the download link and just wgetted the file just, you know, from my phone. It's just a simple copy and paste.
You can copy and paste on your phone?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and it's been out for 2-3 years now. Yeah, Palm Device has been able to copy and paste for a while.
Wow. So that was something Apple finally had innovated just recently.
Oh, well, they did, but people were doing it before. But it's Apple's innovation.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, Palm and even REM had that on their BlackBerries for the longest time now. I mean,
well, didn't you copy and paste on some of the early Palm Pilots?
That I don't know. I never had any of those.
I wish my Sony Clio still worked.
We get I was going to say, where's Pegwell? He'd probably know. I think he said he had one of the early Palm Pilots.
Yeah.
I used to have a handspring visor, and I swear it could copy and paste.
It could. I had a visor as well. It could copy and paste.
I miss my visor. Dude, did yours have the Indiglow thing?
Yeah. Where it lit up in the...
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I miss it. I'd carry that thing around still.
I know, me too. I wanted to see if you could put Linux on it or something, but I guess you can't, but...
What was this device?
It was a Palm Pilot, except it was by this company called Handspring, who I guess they branched off of Palm or something for some reason.
Yeah, something like that.
It was really nice. It was a really nice little... Was yours the flip top 330, the silver one? It just kind of flips up?
No, I had the... it was the same color blue that the Blueberry iMacs were.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that series.
Oh, okay. I've got a picture up on from Amazon right now on it.
They were great. I mean,
you can buy one new for used for $30.
Oh.
And I hear the Palm syncing software in Linux works quite well.
Oh yeah. They had this great thing called the Springboard expansion slot.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It was like it looked kind of like a Nintendo like a Game Boy cartridge.
Yeah.
You could do all kinds of, there were cameras and all kinds of shit you could put in there.
I actually used the handwriting recognition on that almost as much as I did anything else. That was, anyway,
yeah.
You had to, right?
Yeah, that was the only input method.
That worked really well, actually. I was really good at that.
Did it ruin your handwriting forever?
Yeah, I mean, I still do graffiti, or I think they called it graffiti.
Yeah, that's what they called it.
Yeah.
I still forget to cross A's.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why bother? You know, you don't need it. No, for a while, I thought that would surely replace the standard handwriting, but unfortunately it didn't.
Sorry, we can lead the charge.
Yeah, 10 years too late.
Well, remember last week I said I was going to try PCBSD?
Yeah.
Yeah, I gave it a try. I didn't have much luck with it.
Define not having much luck with it.
I went through the installer. I mean, everything seemed like it was working good. The installer is beautiful.
Yeah, it is. I tried that, too.
Went through the whole thing, did the partitioning, went to the point where it started installing everything, and then it would get to about like 50, 60%, and it would just stop and say, seek failed, invalid argument.
Weird.
I found the information from the PCBSD forums, and it seemed like everybody had a SATA DVD drive. So I'm just guessing that might be the problem. But anyways, I tried it three times. I gave up on it. But instead, I threw the free BSD disk in, installed that, and I'm liking it. I mean, it was a really easy install. I mean, I compared, you know, the install to probably like Slackware. You know, if you follow the handbook, it's really simple to install.
The default install just drops you without X or anything, right? It's just a text login, and you install the extra packages from there.
Yeah, during the install, you have a choice to install like extra packages like KDE.
Okay.
But you still don't get X.
Oh, okay.
You still have to configure X by hand.
Okay.
So what's the advantages of BSD over Linux? It's just security is their main objective, is it?
Well, I mean, the main thing would be obviously the kernel. I mean, that's the major difference, I think. Well, I guess a lot of the user space apps are not GNU, huh? Because I don't think BSD and GPL aren't even compatible licenses. Is that correct, or am I just completely wrong?
I mean, I know they're different licenses, but I think they're compatible. So you can mix and match. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in Linux distributions that have the BSD license.
Yeah, I thought I read somewhere on the OpenBSD thing that they weren't including postfix because it was GPL or something weird like that, but I could be wrong. But I mean, I would think that the kernel would be the major difference, although I don't know still what the significance of that is.
What was the question again, Peter? Did you ask what the advantage was or the difference?
No, it seems to me, like, I don't know a lot about BSD, but it seems to me that their main focus is on security. Isn't this the one that Torvalds said they're masturbating monkeys or something? Is that the one?
He said that specifically about the OpenBSD people, I think.
Right, but he was sort of insinuating that they concern themselves more about making the kernel very secure than doing anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading a book on the Linux kernel, like Understanding the Linux Kernel by O'Reilly, and they're talking a lot about, like, you know, a monolithic kernel versus a modular kernel or whatever the other version is, stuff like that. I still don't understand any of it, but I'm assuming that that's where it's going to be a big difference. User apps, from what I could tell, especially when I was playing around with like Dragonfly BSD and OpenSolaris and just what I know of Linux, it just seems like the user space apps are just kind of like, they're either all the same anyway, you know, like you see send mail and post fix and things like that, or they're just really, really similar and just seem to function almost exactly the same way, even though they might, I mean, some of them might even be called the same thing, but there's like a, you know, maybe a Linux version of Top and a BSD version of, well, I think Top is all the same, but like, I don't know, CP or something. You know, there might be a GNU version, there might be a BSD version, there might be a Spun version. They all do this basically the same thing. It doesn't seem like that would be the significant difference. It seems like the big deal would be a lot lower level than that. But so far, I haven't seen really much of a difference between performance, but I guess I haven't really, like, rigorously tested, you know, BSD versus Linux versus Solaris.
Yeah, I might just have a look at it, throw it on a machine one day, have a bit of a play with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably worth it. You should try both FreeBSD and, I would give OpenSolaris a go if I were you. I found
it interesting. I did play with Solaris ages ago. It came out on a magazine. I know Jay Lindsay was talking about, he's playing with PC BSD at the moment. He said that's pretty good. You were talking about monolithic kernels and that, and anyone who's interested, Dan covered it on a HPR episode a while back too, which was an interesting one.
Yeah.
About the different types of kernels, if anyone's interested in listening.
Yeah, his episode on the kernel and the boot process, man, those are just fantastic episodes.
Yeah, they're episodes you can go back and listen to a couple of times.
Yeah.
And keep referring back to. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
Because they're pretty complex, and you keep picking up something different every time.
Yeah, once I installed FreeBSD, I don't see any difference between using Linux or FreeBSD.
What about some of the command line applications, though? They're all the same? You're not running into things where you're trying to type something in and you'll use an option or a switch and it won't do it or something? Or
by default, the terminal is a bourne shell.
Yeah.
But you can easily put bash in there if you want.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's up to you. You have, like, you can choose any shell you want.
Sure.
So, I mean, I haven't really run into any problems just using the bourne shell, but I do plan on changing it to bash.
And they've got all the command line applications that you'd expect, like ifconfig, iwconfig, ehclients, I don't know, you know, those kinds of things?
I really haven't, needed them, so I don't know.
Okay.
And I don't have that system booted up right now.
Yeah. I'm just curious about that, because I know that when I was trying Solaris, it was just, I can't tell you how many times I would go to do something that I would normally do, you know, in Slackware or whatever, and it would just, I would get slowed down because I didn't know the equivalent of those commands, and I thought they were really common commands, but maybe not.
Well, I know, like, the the labeling of, you know, your hard drives and
and
your network
and
cards.
Network interfaces.
All that's different.
That confused me a lot too.
Now, with these BSDs, can you still use Grub and Dual Boot?
They have their own bootloader. I'm not sure what it's called. But you can dual boot with another operating system.
So if I went and installed, say, PC BSD, and it installed a bootloader, it would override Grub, but I'd still have my Arch install on the bootloader.
Yeah, I have no idea how that works.
Right. So probably a good idea is to use it on a machine that you don't need, just in case.
Yeah, that's what I did. It's FreeBSD's on its own box right now.
Yeah, I've got this week off, so I might grab that PC BSD and have a play with it.
Yeah, the FreeBSD, their ports collection, as of right now, I'm looking at the page, there's 20,457 ports, and there's also that many packages, too. I don't know if you know the difference, if you know about ports or not.
No, what's that about?
Well, the ports are source code that you would navigate to your ports directory. Like, say you want to install IRSSI. You would change to the directory /ports/IRC, then /IRSSI, and you would just type in make, and make will, it fetches the source code, patches it, configures it, and compiles it. And then once it completes, you type in make install, and then it just installs it for you. Now, if you don't want to compile this, you can use a package instead, a binary, and you can just type in pkg_add-r and then IRSSI, and then just install the binary.
Now, does the port thing, does that resolve dependencies?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And it compiles those dependencies as well, or what?
Yep, it compiles everything.
Wow, that's pretty good.
You know, I'm new to it, but there's a way to pick and choose what you want to compile.
Sure.
So you can, like, say, you know, I want this, but this dependency, pull down the binary instead.
I see. Interesting.
Once you've installed this, then you went and installed KDE. If you didn't drop down to the command line, you wouldn't know whether you're running Linux or FreeBSD, I take it. But it'll look exactly the same.
Pretty close. I mean, if you had Bash, I mean, it'd be pretty much the same thing. I mean, like I said, installing it, it kind of felt like Slackware. But once you have it installed, it kind of has that Gentoo feel to it, unless you're using the binaries. I mean, it's just different.
Well, now I see why Jeff Grimmel was saying that SBOPKG was sort of influenced by the ports thing, because that sounds a little bit like SBOPKG, except that it doesn't do dependency port does. But you go through, you kind of find your stuff, and then it actually compiles it for you and installs it, which I like a lot. I like, you know, having it compiled rather than just pulling down a binary, personally.
Yeah, it's kind of nice because, you know, like the, you know, if you like to do the, you know, the compiling of everything, that's fine. But like, say it's something big like Firefox or KDE or GNOME,
yeah.
You can just pull down the, you know, the pre-built binary.
Yeah. So FreeBSD.com didn't have any problems with your DVD drive then?
No, not the FreeBSD.
That's interesting. PCBSD is based on FreeBSD, isn't it? I mean,
right.
Directly.
Yep.
That's weird. It's really strange. Yeah, I mean, I tried installing FreeBSD as well, and it did install. I didn't have the link to the manual. You'd given me the link a little bit later, but I didn't really play around with it. But PCBSD wouldn't install on my computer either, but Free would install. Now I have to play around with it a little bit more now.
Yeah, once you install it, I mean, during the install you set up everything like your networking and.
How would it go on a laptop and getting? I would imagine that trying to get a Broadcom wireless card or a Theros wireless card working probably would be a hell of a lot harder than in Linux.
I thought the Atheros drivers were actually open and free.
Oh, right. So they're probably built into the BSD kernel.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Or at least easily obtainable.
I've just never heard of anyone running it on a laptop, but I suppose not being in that sort of community and that, you probably wouldn't.
Yeah, I think I've met a couple of people running BSD on a laptop. I don't know. I didn't ask for details, though. And there is some kind of Linux binary compatibility layer I know that BSD has. Don't know the details on that, though. I don't know how far that would go to help with those kinds of issues.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that works. I went ahead and installed it, you know, during the install because it asked you. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I just went ahead and put it in there, but I have no idea how to use it or the only thing I can think of, because I noticed there's, like, in the ports collection, there's a Linux Firefox version, so I have no idea what the advantage to that is over just the regular Firefox version.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just looking at the PCBSD forum, and there's pages and pages in the laptop section, so obviously it's pretty easy to get running on a laptop.
Yeah, I think the I just wish I could have tried it out because it does look nice from the screenshots.
But once again, the screenshots, you'd be looking at KDE, I take it.
Yeah,
is that right?
The default, yeah.
Yeah, because you're probably experiencing as much PC BSD as you running free BSD as you would if you had actually gotten PC BSD to install. Sure, there's no difference, or no substantial difference. Probably the installation is the part that's really different.
Once you've got your core system set up, then you pretty well can install any Windows manager you like GNOME and Fluxbox and whatever else.
Whatever you want to put on there.
Yeah.
You just got to install X first.
Yeah, so very similar to Arch install.
But the handbook is really nice. It's very well written, and plus it's updated, each release that they have. So they're on the release right now for FreeBSD 7.2. So when 8 comes out, then the handbook will be updated too. So it's always going to be updated, and that's worth a read anyways. They got one chapter and they're just on Unix commands.
Nice.
So most of the stuff in there you can use with Linux too. But I don't really see it. I don't think it's difficult to install or use. And over the past couple of years, I've seen people talking about it, saying that FreeBSD or BSD is like 5 years behind Linux. I mean, technology-wise, I don't see it. I mean, they have almost the same amount of packages as Debian. The only thing I can see that they would be talking about is Flash. I think they're at version 7.
What about drivers for some of the more common peripherals like, say, scanners and web cameras? I suppose you haven't been using it long enough for that sort of thing, but maybe the development in those sort of areas is a bit behind.
Yeah, I have no idea about that. I don't see why it would be, but...
Really, Linux didn't have, web cameras until maybe, 12, 18 months ago. Now, what about video editing? I'll be interested to look at that, actually.
They've got all the same user apps, basically. I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, I suppose. Yeah, so it'd be just KDEN Live.
Yeah, and it's based off of, FFmpeg or some underlying thing like that, and that's just... That compiles on everything I've ever tried to compile it on.
Yeah, yeah.
ESP to Mac to Linux.
Well, it really is of talking me out of even looking at it, because I don't think I'm going to see anything new.
That's kind of why I kind of gave up on it. I was just like, well... Probably the same thing as any given Linux distribution, except without the GPL. So, why bother?
Mm.
Having said that, I'm probably going to have another play around with GPL. Possibly put BSD anywhere. The live open BSD on my external SSD card slot on my triple EPC. See if that works.
Yeah, I'd like to try that too.
I'll let you know how it goes. I'm probably going to do it tonight. Downloaded it last night, but never got around to actually putting it on there.
Yeah, I think what I like about it the most is the handbook, how everything is standard. So, you know what I mean? There's a lot of ways you can do things, but the way that manual says to do it, it's going to work.
Yeah, but how much of this is going to work because you are Monster B and you know what you're doing, around a Unix system? And how much is it? Do you think someone picking up Unix for the first time, or maybe not the first time, but someone still getting kind of developing their chops on Unix, do you think they could? Do you think this would be better or worse than say Slackware or Arch, or the same?
I would say the same. Most likely, once they sit down and read the manual and start installing it, they'll probably stick with the first one they install.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to keep this on my second system. And I like to get Synergy going and see how that works. Yeah, I'm looking through the free BSD port search. No matter what I put in there, I find it.
Now, here's a question on the ports that you're searching for. Do the version numbers seem to be on par with, the average Linux distro?
Yeah, it does. Like when I put Firefox in there, it's 3.5.1.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I played with FreeBSD, and I think it might have been OpenBSD you know, a few years ago. And the only thing that kind of annoyed me is, you know, some of the packages were maybe a version or two at the most behind, but that wasn't a real big deal. It was a little bit of a curve going from a Linux system to the BSD system because it's a little bit different, but I imagine if I had spent some time and actually sat down and played with it, it wouldn't have been too hard to get a grasp on it.
Okay, they have two branches. They have the stable, which is the release, the release, 7.2 release is what I'm running now, so that's stable. But there's also a current, which is going to be the 8.0.
Yeah, I was going to say that's going to be 8, isn't it?
Yeah. So I guess if you're running, like right now, 7.2 just came out, I think, in May or June. So it's really not that old. But I guess in a few months, I mean, some of the packages are going to start showing their age if you're going by version numbers. But you can always run current, get the latest packages.
Yeah, and that's the same thing I always did with Slackware. I just ran current.
Yeah, I think if you're using these systems for, like, everyday computing and not just throwing it on a server or something, I think running current is probably the way to go. You do get all the up-to-date stuff, cool, neat features.
Yeah, the only package that I'm kind of disappointed with for version number is GPotter.
But surely, I mean... Oh, I see. Okay, and so that's in the ports repository or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's because of Chess Griffin. He needs to get on it and update it.
Chess doesn't have anything to do with GPotter, or he maintains...
He maintains the package for it, or the port.
Oh, how funny. Wow. Well, let's jump in his IRC channel and tell him about it.
Yeah, the last update to the last port version was 0.15, and they're up to 0.16.1. Yeah, it shows his name right on there, too, on the GPotter website. Go to the download section.
Yeah, I got to learn how to package things. So with some random application I think should be in some repository and make note to myself. I got to learn how to package that, get it in there. And, of course, I haven't learned yet. Yeah.
Like Slack builds, how are they pretty difficult to make?
You know, the time I sat down for, like, 3 days straight and tried to learn that, my problem was that I was trying to learn it for, like, Blender or something. I was trying to package something way above my head. So I need to sit down and do that again with something a lot, you know, simpler, a lot more... a nice little simple app like Normalize or something like that, some command line little app,
right,
without too many dependencies. So yeah, I need to return to that kind of level.
I would try HTOP. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, I could try HTOP. They might already have that though.
Yeah, they already have one, but you can always do it again just for practice.
That's true. But see, I can't find a little levelator app sort of. It's called Normalize. And I can't find that so far in Slack package or anything like that. So.
And how good is that working?
It works great. I use it all the time.
I'm going to have to try it.
Yeah, I think in Debian it's Normalize-Audio. They changed the name to Normalize-Audio, although I always alias it to just Normalize because Normalize-Audio is too much to type. But it is in the Debian repository, so.
Yeah, I'm looking for it now. I'll use it for this show. Yep, there it is. Now, how come I couldn't find this before when I was looking for one?
Because you didn't ask me.
I know. I was using Levelator.
Yeah, you know, I tried out Levelator, and you know, aside from the nice little screen thing that it's got, that little drag and drop area that looks so cool, I didn't really find it like all that. I don't know, I didn't really see the big deal. And then it kept breaking every time you updated your distro. You know, then you'd have to, like, go in and tweak Levelator or something, you know?
Right, because it's non-free and it...
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it's kind of weird. So Normalize works for me, but having said that, I don't... No, you know, I used it on the round table and I think it worked okay. I was going to say I haven't used it where there's, like, 5 or 6 different people with different levels, you know. I just use it on myself to boost my signal and lower my noise. But yeah, try it out on this one. See what happens. Word of warning: it is destructive. So make a copy of the audio file before you run it through normalize.
All right. Well, I'm hoping
it overwrites it.
Because I hear a turkey in the background, so I'm hoping it brings that up.
Yeah, that would be great.
So we can hear the turkey.
Yeah.
Glad you can hear it. I was starting to think that was just me, and I was getting hungry.
Getting hungry.
Should be big and fat in time for Thanksgiving, shouldn't it?
Like, that's a stupid comment. Get in the bin.
You gonna throw me in the...
Yeah, that'll teach him. Fartu, you should have been onto that.
You're right.
Deputy.
You're right.
Peter, here's the thing. You know, how many times has Zook been in the bin now?
And not enough.
Apparently not enough.
I was gonna say, he still has it learned. I don't know if it's working. You're gonna have to resort to different tactics.
Well, I can't shoot the poor bloke. Right off the black.
Peter, I can shoot him.
Oh, thanks, Mrs. Hank. Hang him from the nearest yardarm, wherever you hang people.
Well, has anybody got anything else to say before I end this?
Not me.
I think this show was over an hour ago, but...
Nah, we got a lot of good BSD chat in there. That'll be good for something.
Yeah. And
I don't use BSD on anything important, so, you know,
yeah,
I don't have much
true.
Data.
That's a good one.
The tables are turned.
But since it's 40 years of Unix, I figured I would throw it on there to celebrate.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Beautiful thing to do. Somewhere some bearded Unix admin is very happy with you.
But the song tonight is by the Dead Ranch Hands, and the name of the song is called Stranger. So after the song, I'll talk to you guys in the after show. All right, good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. I'm sitting in the bin. Thank you.
Okay, after show starts now.
Has anyone looked at this, how the Swedish Pirate Party platform backfires on free software?
Yeah. With,
yeah.
Anyone have any thoughts on it? Because I'm still formulating mine.
I think he's right.
But is there a way to save software freedom and lower the copyright terms? Because I'm the life of the creator plus 70 years is a little much.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, just like what Stallman is saying, like, have some kind of waiting period or something like that, you know? I mean, that would do what you're... That would do it, right? I mean, in theory.
Well, if it's the life of the creator, there could be a lot of unfortunate accidents.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But, I mean, the original copyright term in America was 14 years.
That's so much more sensible.
Well, that makes absolute sense. Because really, in I know in England they did a test on this. The actual, like, usable copyright term is only 7 years. Like, after that, the after 7 years of creating something, the money you actually make from it diminishes quickly.
I mean, I still think they ought to have... I mean, to get everyone on board, because let's face it, we're going against Disney for copyright, because they're worried that, you know, Mickey Mouse is going to run out of copyright, because he's...
Yeah, even though that Mickey Mouse himself was a violation of copyright.
Yeah, Mickey Mouse himself was ripped off from Buster Keaton or something, wasn't it? Which
Steamboat
was ripped
Willie.
Off from... Yeah, but that was... was that Buster Keaton in the movie? But that was... Steamboat Willie was based off of the story about the train driver, the American folklore, Casey Jones. Thank you, Mr. Soak. And so it's, you know, it's so screwed up anyway. The whole thing was like ripped off. And, oh, wait, no, it's copyright now. But I'm thinking you need to say something like... We also have the problem with all these people that have patents and stuff out that are just assholes because they don't do anything with them. So I'm thinking you need to have some sort of rule that... You need to be actively using the patent or something. Otherwise, it has a really short lifespan. Literally, like a few years and it's gone. Unless you're actually doing something with it.
Yeah, but it's going to be really, really hard to determine what doing something with it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you need to... So you know, if it's like a movie, you know, the character The Terminator, for example, you know, obviously, they've done a few new movies. So you're like, okay... You get another 10 years of it, let's say.
Yeah, but why don't we just give them 14 years flat out?
Yeah, exactly.
So then the guy that's trying to create the Terminator in real life has 14 years to try it.
Because then I don't think Disney's going to be interested.
We'll see. Cause,
and they've got a lot of money to go against Congress and play people up and say, no, let's not do it. That's just what I was just thinking that, you know, obviously it'd be better if we have very little at all, but if you're going to try and take what we have and reduce it, to try and say, well, okay, if you're actively, you know, if you've made a movie in the and it has to be, you know, at least 70% new content or something to try and, because otherwise, you know, Disney every 2 years bring out a new version of
the fucking Little Mermaid. Jesus
like that.
Christ.
So stuff like that doesn't count because that's just like a re-editing. But because otherwise I don't think Disney is going to be interested with it at all, and they're just going to say no. So I'm thinking we ought to get something through realistically. We have this compromise. We dangle a bit of a carrot and say, look, if you're still using it, you know, you're still making Mickey Mouse cartoons, so, okay, we'll let you have Mickey Mouse because you're still actively doing cartoons and stuff. And if you don't make a certain number a year, then you lose the copyright on it. Because I don't think otherwise you're going to get anyway. Because if you turn around and say 14 years, every single, you know, the MPAA, the RIAA, all of those are just going to turn around and say, ain't gonna happen, and they've got the bucks to force it through Congress and stuff. So I think the only way we're gonna do this is to actually say, look, we'll give you this, but if you don't actively use it, and exactly what you mean by actively use would have to be very strictly monitored and explained. You know, but I think unless you're gonna do that, you're not gonna get anything because people are just gonna turn around and say, you know, the company's just gonna turn around and say, no. And then you're not going to get it through Congress because they've got huge amounts of money to put all the, what's the word? When they pay people to...
Lobbyists.
Yes, thank you. both you and the wife came up at the same time. Yeah, but I just think because they've got all the lobbyists, we're not going to get anything sane through unless we offer a compromise. At least that's my thoughts anyway. I mean, obviously, I don't think that's the best way to go. We can improve it, but I think it's the only option we'll have to actually get something through Congress to say, okay, this is the thoughts. And then if you have that, if you're not actively doing it, all those companies that have bought up all the patents, well, they're not doing anything with it. They lose them. So I think it would also remove that as well. As I said, I think it's better than what we have, but could be better still. But I think that's the best compromise we'd actually get something through. Anyway, discuss. Don't all talk at once.
Well, I mean, you said it all, didn't you?
I mean, do you think that sounds reasonable? I mean,
well,
do you think people would actually go for that?
Yeah, essentially we're screwed, is what it
is. Well, yeah. But, I mean, do you think people would actually be vaguely interested in that? Because it gives them they keep doing stuff, it gives them a way to keep hold of the copyright?
Well, see, that's the thing is, people are going to be stoked about it. But, you know, I think Disney and all those people are going to hate it just because
they want absolute control and just take a little bit of that away from them. Although, I don't think they would hate it so much. I mean, if it was forced upon them, I mean, they would just, like you say, they'd have, like, I mean, they're big corporations. They'd have some person sitting around at a desk all day making it look like legally they are doing something with every single copyright they own. You know, I mean, they would find the loophole and exploit it. That's what companies do best. They'd still have their 70-year patent.
I say, but, say, on top of this, is there a way to save free software?
Save it from whom? Or from what?
Well, yeah, the pirate party, you've got your, what they say, 5 years, I think it is?
Yeah.
And then whatever it is goes into the public domain, which then allows for proprietary software vendors to then take free software, make it no longer free, and then restrict people on top of it with things like EULAs.
Right,
Yeah, and it would be really easy to do as long as we only distributed binaries, because there's no real usable source code in a binary.
Right.
You know, we can license the terms of the use of the binary, but...
Yeah, maybe that's the part I'm not understanding then, because, I mean, because in his blog post it says, the proprietary users would be able to, companies would be able to use the free stuff, but free developers couldn't use the proprietary stuff. But why would that be? I mean, it wouldn't be proprietary anymore because it would be released into the public domain.
Well, after 5 years.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
See, so, they would be able to take our code.
Yeah, immediately.
Yeah, well, they'd be able to take it at the end of the 5 years when the copyright is up because, we'll use just the GPL for sake of argument,
sure.
is a copyright license. It's like the Creative Commons or something, it's...
Right.
It uses the protection of copyright as an enforcement mechanism. So after 5 years, they could take our code and do whatever we want with it. But then we would have to wait 5 years to see what they did with it.
I see.
That entire time, they're keeping users from having software freedom.
Yeah. It's also theoretical, I guess. Because, I mean, who is the...
Oh, yeah, this is...
I mean, it's just like, okay, the Pirate Party, but I don't know if they're, like, that mainstream yet to really...
No, they just got 2 seats in the parliament. But, I mean, even my blog post about this, which isn't very long, I used science fiction as a tag. I mean, this is all extreme speculation at this point, but...
Right, yeah.
I think we kind of have to get started.
Yeah. And that's... Yeah, I mean, that's a very preliminary kind of idea that they've got anyway. I mean, they got 2 seats, and they're up against Disney in the USA. it's not going to... I'm sure that if... They may not know about the GPL. They may not be privy to that outside of the equation. So they could go in and do a little bit of consulting and they could be like, oh, yeah, you see how that doesn't work.
So what I'm personally worried about is the proprietary software vendors taking free software, slapping a EULA on top of it, which, keeps you from sharing the free software, as it is inside the non-free software.
and then them using DRM to make it absolutely unusable even after the mm-hmm. the 5 or 4 years, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that'd be something they would do.
Yeah, and at what point do you, yeah, you know, now you have to relinquish your encryption keys for your DRM. So
yeah.
Then they have to keep, you know, if I was a DRM company, I'd be pissed because you'd constantly have to redo your work. Because, you know, you hand someone the keys and they can unlock it. This is a big epic mess. I really do want to see Cory Doctorow and Larry Lessig weigh in on this.
Yeah, yeah.
And those two guys are much smarter than I.
There are no ethics corporations. All there is a legal department. If the legal guy says you can get away with it, it's ethical.
Yeah, really. All right, guys, I'm out of here. I'm going to go see if I can get this BSD anywhere on my card slot on this triple E. So I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, later on.
See you, Klaatu.
See ya.
Night, Klaatu.
Yeah, good night, Klaatu.
I think I'm going to sneak out of here, too.
All right, later on, Monster B.
Good night, everyone.
Night, see you, Monster B.
Good night.
Good night, Monster B.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.